This podcast includes content funded by the British Podcast Award Fund and the Wellcome Trust. Our next guest is Dr. Jonathan Leach. After serving 25 years in the British Army, he left and is now a GP, Associate Medical Director for NHS England for Military and Veteran Health, and is currently the clinical lead at the Royal College of GPs for COVID-19.
My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter and soldier. I run a veteran-owned business and I'm an ambassador for Lululemon. And it's in these episodes we bring together all of these communities to support society during the COVID-19 pandemic. We speak to experts, friends, and community leaders to talk about best practice, mental fitness, growth, and the facts. This is brought to you by the Declassified Network. And this is Declassified COVID-19.
Jonathan, what is COVID-19?
Yeah, so it's the disease caused by a particular virus. The virus actually is now being called, and this is a usual medical term, severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2, or SARS-CoV-2. But it causes the disease called COVID-19. So people will see that there are various names around for this. And coronavirus is, if you like, the overarch name for this type of viruses. So it's similar to other types of viruses. A cold virus would be a coronavirus. So this is the particular one that we're obviously worried about, that's obviously going around the world. So that's really what it is.
And how does it actually affect the body?
So the problem is that the body, or we as humans, don't have immunity to this one. So flu, for example, is a coronavirus. So what's different from this one to other sort of flu-like illnesses is that the normal sort of influenza virus, it's normally a variation on the virus we've had before. So we've got some immunity to it. So what it's called is you get what's called a drift. So normal flu virus, it drifts gently as that mutates from one year into the next. What's different about this, and it was the same for the Spanish flu, as it was called, for 1918, and also the epidemic 11 years ago, it was a shift. And the difference is that this was such a change in the genetic code that actually we'd got no immunity to it. So that's the difference, is that, you know, this one's new. And so when it comes into contact with humans, our immune system has to learn all about it again. And that's the reason why it's such a problem. Now, for the vast majority of people, it's a flu-like illness and it's relatively mild. It's not very nice. Quite a few of my friends have had it so far. As far as I'm aware, I haven't, but no doubt will. But where the problem comes is particularly if people have got other medical problems, if they've got heart disease or diabetes, they're overweight, smoke, things like that, then it really just adds on to those. And that's where the particular problem is. And that's obviously where it's been found to be very bad news in China, in Spain, and in Italy. And obviously, we're now seeing that in the UK.
So it gets into the body. Firstly, how does it get into the body? And then what does it physically do on maybe a cellular level when it's in there?
So, yeah, so the main form of transmission is, you know, as I'm of the age where coughs and sneezes spread diseases. And that's the main way. You know, you can also catch it from, if it's on a surface and then you breathe it in, and particularly into the sort of nose and mouth. And that's why people are being told to sort of wash their hands, is to stop that, and then also to stop me breathing it in, that it does that. And then what viruses do is that they take over cells. So essentially there are, you know, broadly, there are a number of type of germs. It's a type of germ. So the common ones that people would think of would be bacteria. You might think of things like a urinary tract infection or a chest infection. Most of those are due to bacteria. They're bigger organisms. You can actually see them under a normal microscope. Viruses are much, much smaller. You can only see them under an electron microscope. And what they do is that they actually get into the cells, often take over the cells, sometimes kill the cells. And then it's as a consequence of that. And other viruses, for example, would be chickenpox or measles. And there are a large number, which clearly can be very nasty on the body, just alongside, obviously, this one.
What does our immune system actually do then? So does it attack the virus, or can it hinder us as well?
So what normally happens if we get an infection is that we hope that our body will learn about it. And then what immunization does is actually giving us the memory, if you like, that we've seen it before. So our immune system can then mount an attack against something. That's normally what our immune system does. So let's take one of the vaccinations which most of us have had. Let's take the measles vaccine. The idea of that is that our immune system is primed, if you like, with that measles vaccine. And then if the measles virus then comes along, the body recognizes it and then actually can then develop antibodies, which then goes and kills it. The difficulty comes with this one, or for example, if you've not had the measles vaccine and you come across measles, is that the disease can then be, you know, can then go around the body and cause, you know, the effects that it does. So in effect, what the vaccination is doing is giving you that memory, the immune memory, so that your immune system will then attack the disease, therefore protecting us. And that's essentially, you know, what vaccinations do. And for those of us, particularly who are in the military, you know, we have many, many vaccinations over many years. And of course, that's, you know, to protect us as we're on military operations. So that's essentially what it does. But it's the immune system that's the key bit here.
Why have the government guidelines been the way they are, as in self-isolation, you know, good hygiene, the rest of it? Why has it been firstly so simple, and what are we seeing the benefits of it now, or are we seeing the benefits of it now on a kind of NHS level?
So, as I said earlier, the problem is that we don't have immunity to this. And we also haven't got any medicines which will kill off the virus. There's lots of research going on. So the whole thing of the strategy is to try and reduce or spread out the number of cases who unfortunately get it, and particularly those who might get it very badly and might require the sort of hospital care and particularly intensive care. So the idea is, by spreading it out and flattening the curve, as the government have said, is that what we're able to do is then to save lives by virtue of the fact that we've got much more of an NHS capacity available. So that, you know, heroic, Herculean efforts to build things like NHS Nightingale, because obviously, you know, we wouldn't normally require the numbers of intensive care beds that, you know, we would for this. And that's been a strategy right across the world, certainly the Western world, that they've put in lots of additional intensive care beds. So the idea then is to be able to spread it out, and we can save lives by being able to then apply high-level Western medicine to this, particularly intensive care, and that's really what the strategy is. But clearly, it is at a cost that we are asked to self-isolate. And essentially, it's to try and prevent us giving it to other people. It's very simple. And the hygiene things are to make sure that we don't get it. And the most important things are the hand washing, you know, particularly regularly, and, you know, the distancing that we've got, so we don't catch it from other people and therefore give it to other people ourselves. And that's really, it's quite a simple strategy, but clearly, obviously, at the moment is having a major impact, not just upon the UK, but around the world.
Mm. You mentioned they're treating it and with a lack of appropriate medicine right now. Antibiotics, they won't work.
Yeah, that's correct. So antibiotics work against bacteria. So if I saw somebody with a urinary tract infection, as an example, we would give antibiotics for that, and the number we would use, and that's well known. But we've got very, very few medicines which treat viruses. We've got a few. So if, for example, somebody develops shingles, which is a horrid rash, it's very painful on the chest or on the tummy, then we will use an antivirus. But there's lots of research going on at the moment about whether or not some of these antivirus medicines might be effective against coronavirus. But it's too soon to say. And then there are other medicines, some of the antimalarials, particularly things like chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine, which again have been in the news. They've got some antivirus properties, but it's too soon to say. So the treatments in hospital are actually supportive. It's making sure that people have steroids, it's giving them fluids, making sure they're looked after, and then allowing their body to recover, you know, particularly if they need support by breathing. And giving them oxygen. So that broadly is what the treatment is. But we've got nothing like an antibiotic that can actually go and kill the virus. Your body has to do it itself.
With regards to being a GP and giving advice or having more people or less people come into the practice or certainly going over kind of over the internet and giving consultation, how do we actually treat if someone's showing signs or symptoms?
So, well, the first thing is right across the country, you know, quite amazingly, actually, we've probably in 3 weeks moved what we would have done in 10 years. Now, I was in the surgery yesterday and I was regularly consulting with my patients over video. Actually, it's very effective. There were some very sensitive conversations I was having. You know, for example, it was with a very elderly lady and her daughter about, you know, as she comes towards the end, nothing to do with coronavirus. This lady's in her mid-90s. And so, you know, we were doing that over video phone and quite amazing that we're able to do that. But we're certainly getting lots and lots of queries about it, you know, whether or not people can go to work, whether or not they need to stay at home, you know, what the risks are, you know, what they should do. You know, all sorts of things. And obviously, you know, we've been sort of providing a lot of information, certainly from a college GP's perspective, to the profession on this in order to be able to support GPs, support their patients. So lots and lots of queries. And then we've restructured in that if I speak to somebody and they've got symptoms, let's say they've got a high fever, maybe, you know, a little bit of a cough and things like this, and it's likely that they've got COVID-19, coronavirus, then the normal advice is if they're okay, they stay at home, they take paracetamol, and most people it will settle. It's not very nice, but it will settle. Where we get worried is if somebody, for example, becomes very short of breath, if they become delirious and confused, and obviously, as I said earlier, if somebody's got underlying medical problems, and under those circumstances, they would be the ones that we'd be thinking about whether or not they ought to be going into hospital. But the bulk, actually, they don't. And that's part of the strategy, is to be able to sort of differentiate between those groups and only send to hospital those who need to go there.
Can COVID-19, especially if you had a mild case of it, can it develop into something else? Can it weaken the immune system and then you develop a bacterial infection, for example?
Yeah, so one of I think there are two things. The first thing is that what seems to happen is that people get a viral illness. And as I say, the vast majority get better. But there's then sometimes what happens in the second week, the immune system, if you like, goes on overdrive. And this is what the experience from China, Italy and Spain, particularly, the immune system goes on overdrive. And actually that causes problems in itself. And then secondly, you can then get other infections that can come afterwards. So antibiotics are used not because they will kill the virus, because they don't. But antibiotics are used to prevent other infections coming on afterwards. And we would do that in the community, just as hospital colleagues would as well. So essentially, that's what happens. But in hospital medicine, you know, the pictures on the TVs of, you know, intensive care nurses and doctors, and, you know, wearing the personal protective equipment, that's obviously to protect themselves so that they can continue to work. And from us in primary care, we've got our own PPE. It's something we're having to do in order to keep ourselves safe, so that we can actually then make sure that we're available to see the patients who need to see us.
What is an infectious disease, and what's the differentiator between infectious / and a disease?
So an infectious disease is where you can catch it. Disease is, unease, if you like, disease, as the name says. So an infectious disease would be like this, measles or chickenpox or German measles. They are infectious because you can catch it from one person to another. If we took something else, let's say somebody who's had a heart attack, that's, still a type of, if you like, illness or disease. But it's not one which you can catch. And that's probably the difference. That's due to perhaps somebody who smoked over a period, maybe, they've got a family history, they've got maybe high cholesterol, things like this. So, diseases come in lots of different types. And it's just what is the underlying cause that's the issue. But the thing about this one, obviously, it's infectious. And so what we think is that for COVID-19, unless we do the self-distancing and self-isolation, each person gives it to another three people. Now, it doesn't sound very many, but what happens is each person gives it to another three, and what happens is it then multiplies. And you can see, if you put that in perspective, for normal flu, seasonal flu, it's about 1.6. And then if we go measles, which is probably about the most infectious disease, it's between 12 and 18, and that's why measles is so infectious. So, within a few days, you can find that, the numbers are really ramping up as one person gives it to three, those three each give it to three, those all give it to another. You can see how the numbers go, and that's why the problem of infectious disease is so important in terms of understanding. This figure is called the replication number, what's called the R0, is really important. And they say measles probably is one of the most infectious.
If we look at this from a military point of view, and we look at infectious disease, and we look at trauma, and just to maybe just go a bit over history now, because you put in hostile environments, especially during the ages of war fighting, I'm not talking about recent, but historical, has there been a link between infectious disease and death? And has there been more of that or less than that than there has of the actual trauma from conflict?
So if we go back through history, the Royal Army Medical Corps, of which I was a member for 25 years, if we go back in history, and particularly pre-antibiotic era, there were more people who became unwell and died from infectious disease, particularly things like water, which was unclean, or other infectious disease. Traditionally, you found that more people died of infectious disease than died of physical trauma. And that probably was up until around about the Second World War or thereabouts, when penicillin came in. For more recent conflicts, because of the fact we now have an understanding of how these things are transmitted, we also have vaccinations. So, those long queues I used to have in the gymnasia in Senlager as troops were deploying to, places with, hot and horrible, with things that bite at night, I think is probably the good way of putting it, where we were vaccinating people as soldiers went off. Actually, that was to prevent. And that was actually because we got the science that understood that actually we needed to be able to do this. And then for those of us who served in Telic and Herrick and places like this, those hand washing facilities which we had, with, somebody on the desk, it doesn't matter who you are, sir, you will wash your hands before you come in. Those simple things, a bit like COVID-19 now, are so important because of the fact that then it prevents that transmission of things, in that case, things like food poisoning, from your hands into your mouth, and then getting diarrhea, and then making you ineffective as a soldier. So actually, sometimes these really, really simple things, but that's on the basis that we actually understand science and we understand how these were transmitted. Whereas if we go to beginning of the 20th century, we didn't have that science. And there were many, many military doctors, particularly people like David Bruce, who discovered brucellosis and also the causes of sleeping sickness. They were military doctors who actually discovered these diseases and actually then put in place mechanisms so that actually people couldn't get them, and which had an effect not just on the military operations, but on worldwide health, actually, you know, really, really important people.
I was in the National Army Museum a month or so ago, and I was reading about Florence Nightingale and what the kind of processes and systems she brought back from conflict. And it is amazing, these simple measures that are put in, and a lot of it does come from war, essentially. And if we stay with that name, really, Nightingale, and we look at hospitals that are popping up and NHS hospitals that have been well established for years, what are we going to learn, or what can the NHS learn from the military, especially this last kind of 20 years, and all the studies and all the information that places like King's are producing now?
And I think there's a huge amount, and, you know, it's huge credit to, you know, everybody's been involved. You know, sort of, if you go back to some of the trauma things, particularly physical trauma, the work that Brigadier Tim Hologitz has done at the Royal Centre for Defence Medicine, you know, around the differences in, you know, the use of tourniquets, the use of blood clotting agents, which, you know, came from Tellock and Herrick, are now actually a routine across the UK in terms of ambulance services, you know, just routine. And, you know, huge credit to, you know, my colleagues there. But then also in terms of things like the sort of NHS Nightingale, if you look at the floor plan, it's on a bigger scale. When I looked at that, and again, huge credit, I haven't been involved with this, but, you know, huge credit to, you know, all the military logisticians, the Royal Engineers. I saw some Royal Engineer stable belts, you know, on the pictures, you know, for my colleagues in the Defence Medical Services, you know, in terms of supporting the NHS, because actually, of course, this is what we do. You know, we set these up, we know how to do them. Okay, it's on a bigger scale, but it's huge credit. So I think there's a lot that people are learning from that. And obviously, we, with our military experience, bring that. And then also, you know, on this podcast, you've heard Professor Neil Greenberg. Previously, I was talking to Neil recently. I think there's a huge amount we can bring to the approach to mental health as well, so that, you know, we're very aware that, you know, when we've got troops going overseas, particularly those who maybe go as individual reinforcements, they are at greater risk of developing potentially mental health problems, particularly PTSD. And so we're bringing that to some of the experiences of NHS Nightingale to, you know, see what we can do to actually, you know, keep mental health difficulties. And particularly if you're seeing people in front of you who are very unwell and perhaps then pass away, you know, that has an impact on us as healthcare workers. And I think due credit to Neil Greenberg in particular, who's been pushing this. And obviously from our side, from the college GPs and myself, you know, we're doing our bit as well, particularly around trying to skill up the GP workforce, because we are expecting that healthcare workers will potentially have an increased number of mental health problems given what they've been through. And that's just a human reaction to the things that seem, just as it would be, you know, from my own operational tours or other tours, you know, that we of the military have been on.
And I think this does come with the territory. You know, you are exposed, especially healthcare workers and emergency service workers, you are exposed to a certain level of trauma. With the advent of the research, especially what Neil's doing with things like moral injury, it's going to raise a lot of best practice to the service, and we'll be able to hit this, and we'll be able to learn, especially this last kind of 20 years, we'll be able to learn a lot. We're kind of getting things right. We're moving in the right direction with regards to kind of mental health with our own cohort of people, those from the military community. I want to address TILS and CTS, and I want to address, has it been negatively impacted during the recent pandemic, but I also want you to explain what TILs and CTS are.
Sure. So it's a bit of a mouthful. So the transition, I've got to get it right myself now, transition intervention liaison service. So this was the service we set up in England for mental health for veterans just over 3 years ago, actually. And it was on the basis of a significant amount of research. We did a lot of sort of formal research with questionnaires, but also a lot of focus groups. And I must say, I must pay due credit to Kate Davis, who's the overall director, and then some of my other colleagues, particularly Andrew Collins, who's, these are not people who have served in the military, but I promise you they get the military. And they're amazing people. And what we did is that we looked at this, and the key messages that people wanted, well, firstly, we recognized that many of the patients actually could be identified prior to leaving the service. And actually, if they weren't picked up then, they often then presented much, much later. And the problem with that was that often that was then, you know, when things were really quite bad. The second thing is that they needed better access and certainly quicker access. And then also that what they wanted was people who get the military. You know, I remember one sergeant saying to me, you know, if I said, well, what's a sergeant? You know, it doesn't matter. I've lost them. You know, you need to get to the military. Again, you don't need to have served, but obviously, you know, you need to understand the culture. You need to understand the language. So what we did, and this was right across England, is that we set this new service up. It's in four main areas. And the key bits are as somebody is leaving the military. So, Michael, you remember as about 2 months before you leave, you go along to see the doc and they do you what's called a pre-release medical. And essentially from then, you can self-refer. Your military GP can refer or the psychiatrist can refer. And so you're referred into the TIL service. And whilst, you know, it occasionally has stretched because the numbers would be great and we'll come back to numbers, the indicator or the target, if you like, is for people to be assessed within 2 weeks. And that was deliberate. And whilst I've said this to, you know, the organisations that run the TIL service numerous occasions, I said, look, you know, whilst in one sense I apologise to you that 2 week, you know, target to be assessed is going to cause you problems because you need to be really quick off the mark. You need staff to be able to do it. And sometimes, you know, if you've got lots of people coming in, that's a real challenge. But in other senses, clinically, I don't apologize and I make no apologies for it because what I'm trying to do and we're trying to do is to intervene earlier before people perhaps, you know, become more unwell, perhaps go downtown, get drunk, get in trouble with the police, then more difficult getting a job and things like this. And you get a spiral down. So it's absolutely deliberate that 2 weeks is there. And then what happens is that it's an assessment. And then bolted onto this is also a therapeutic side, particularly for PTSD, and they've got psychologists. But what we also found is a lot of things are not necessarily inverted commas medical. They could be around housing, they could be around money, they could be around all sorts of things. So if I take the London one, for example, they've got a particular linkage with STOL. And actually, it's nothing to do with the military, it's a housing charity, but having a house makes a huge difference. So we've had just short of 11,000 patients referred into this in just over 3 years, which is a number greater than I think anybody accepted. It's the first time we've ever had national data. And then what the key bits about this are that, you know, people can self-refer. And that, again, is absolutely deliberate. We're trying to make sure that, if you like, the barriers are as low as possible. So about a third of the referrals actually in are self-referrals, 25% are by charities. And actually, although I have personally referred patients in as a GP, we're very, very much in the minority. And I think that's really a very important part of what we've been trying to do in terms of trying to improve the access to a more specialized service for veterans in particular, who get military. And so you got the language. And then obviously in providing this in an NHS service is in a proper sort of therapeutic environment. So essentially that's what TIL is. And I think it was all the way back to, you know, the evidence that we got at the beginning where the waiting lists were too long. Some of the stories, you know, and again, I've said this elsewhere, they were just woeful. It would make you want to weep in terms of the experiences of people. And so we've been trying very, very hard as the NHS England team to address that. And that's really what TIL is. So all the information about it is available on the NHS.UK website. So essentially that's what TIL is. And in terms of the coronavirus, well, the NHS is obviously having to focus on coronavirus as its current main priority. So in fact, I've got data from earlier today. Some of the waiting lists are about the same. Some are slightly longer, as you know, people have had to be slightly reassigned. But you know, we're keeping a very close eye on it to make sure that that is there. And then the other thing, just as for example, I in my GP surgery are now doing a huge amount of consulting by video. They've adapted as well because obviously, you know, the social distancing applies here just as much. So obviously a lot of the providers are also now doing a lot of video consulting. And I expect that actually to be one of the legacies of this, in that we will probably do this much, much more, which I think will be much more acceptable, both to patients and also to us as healthcare workers.
So clearing something up. So TILS is an NHS Veterans Mental Health Transition Intervention and Liaison Service.
Yeah.
And transition when you're coming out. So I know several of my friends who have gone through that process, transitioning out of the military because they've been MD'd with PTSD or a poor mental health condition. So they've transitioned out. Yeah. They've then got into TILS. It is a national service, which is kind of unprecedented. Like, it's an amazing thing to have that kind of large scale. It is an NHS funded service. It's not an MOD funded service. Is that right?
Yep.
So, and in fact,
people don't realize that even if, for example, you were serving, say, for example, I was still on Salisbury Plain or in Catterick or wherever, if I was admitted to the local hospital, it's the NHS that pays for that, not the MOD. So the TIL service is entirely funded by the NHS. It's not funded by the MOD at all.
Right. Okay. So there's still, nothing's ever perfect in any large organization. So there's still waiting lists. Do people get prioritized? So if there's someone that's really bad, will they get seen before someone who's managing themselves well?
Yes. Yeah. So the first bit is an assessment. So if I take where I am here in the West Midlands, a lot of that's done by an ex-Royal Navy nurse called Lynn Davidson, who's, again, just brilliant. So she would speak to that person and look at, you know, how much of a problem there is, you know, how much risk in particular there is. And, you know, and that's what we would do, you know, and then, you know, they would be prioritized according, and particularly it's around sort of risk to themselves and risk to other people. And then what we did 2 years ago is that we put an extra service that sort of bolts into this, which is called the complex treatment service. Now, what we recognized is that there are some people, and I've met quite a number of them. I deliberately have met, I go and speak with them and often with their other halves about what's gone wrong. And I've been very open about doing that. So if you've got somebody who's got long-term problems, often, you know, if they've been, you know, in prison or if they've had problems with alcohol or drugs or something like this, they need a really quite intense amount of help and support. So what the complex treatment service then bolts into this. So if we look at the national guidance by NICE, that's the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. So they published the national guidance on the treatment of PTSD just over a year ago. And Professor Neil Greenberg, who I mentioned earlier, and I were on that group. So broadly, they would recommend between 8 and 12 treatment sessions. Now, if for example, I'll just use an example of one of my NHS patients. I saw somebody recently. She was involved in a car crash a couple of years ago and was cut out of the car. It was a terrible incident for her, but it was a single incident. But actually, she got better on a concerted, relatively short course of treatment, okay? And she was seen as an NHS patient. This is just an NHS patient. But if you've got somebody who's had long-term problems, that length of time just isn't long enough. And so what we did is that in the specifications for the complex treatment service, we gave as a guide, and it's still only a guide, that we would be looking for perhaps, if needed, 32 treatment sessions. And the idea of that is that you often need time to gain somebody's trust. You need time to stabilize, time to treat, and time to reintegrate back into sort of mainstream. And it seems to be very, very effective. We've had I've had lots of interest from, other, Western countries, Australia, Canada, States, about the model because of the fact that it's community-based. And it seems to be very effective. There's no 100% about medicine, but certainly that's where we've been going. And that's how had, in the 2 years it's been running, I think about 1,100 patients through it. And many of those are still there because of the length of treatment. So that's the complex treatment service. And again, that's nationally, but the way people access that is again the same in that the front end is through the till. And then if somebody, for example, has got a long history of problems, what they will do, is put them in contact, and then they would be seen by the complex treatment service, which sometimes is the same organization, sometimes is a different organization, depending on where you are in the country, but they all work very closely together. So essentially that's the complex treatment service.
Finally, what can people do now to support the NHS at this time?
I think there are many things. I think firstly, it's actually follow the government guidance. That's probably the most important thing, is that, we're very busy looking after COVID-19 patients. It is about the social distancing. It is about washing your hands and the hygiene and following the guidance. Those are probably the most important things. Understand the science, understand how this is transmitted. I think there are also things about, that actually if somebody have other things, about which, let's say somebody, has a chest pain or something like that, we still want you to contact the NHS. We still want you to contact your GP. We want you to contact the ambulance service because actually the NHS remains open. It's obviously focusing on COVID-19 at the moment, but the NHS remains open for everything else. And that's a really, really important message. And then essentially it's sort of do our bit. And I think there, if you've got people, who are necessarily having to, shield themselves and keep out of the way because they're, help in terms of, getting their shopping, help in terms of their medication, be a good member of society. And I think the military generally are very good at this. We're very professional people. And one of the comments I often make is that, the military have excellent communication skills. They're brilliant employees because we have education, we have a way of working, we have an ethos, and actually use that for the benefit of our society and ourselves.
We have covered a lot of ground there. I'll make no apology for it, Jonathan. Thank you so much, and we will leave it there. Just a real quick reminder of that website. It's quite simply nhs.uk.